Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 10:02 p.m. and that is Juneau time in Alaska. So I've been out in the water all day. So but do apologize for the late posting of the site and the big picture, long term audio and video for the various different asset classes, since this is a Friday audio. We did have a wonderful day, though. Saw some whales cresting. As we were making our way out in the morning, caught a halibut in the morning, and then a really chunky king salmon in the afternoon, among lots of other excitement. So it was really a fun day for the whole family, and certainly just enjoying the outdoors and the natural beauty of Alaska is gives one a different perspective, particularly when you have to look at everything that's going on out there in the world. But I thought that I would kick off with the advanced decline line for the New York Stock Exchange. So this has been a particularly useful measure of whether the market is in a secular bull or bear. And it's not below the 1,000-day moving average yet, but it is certainly trending lower. We have a very clear sequence of lower rally highs. They've been evident since November of last year. And the measure has been going sideways for most of the last month, but that sequence of lower highs is still in evidence. And until it's back above the 200-day moving average, then we have to give the benefit of the doubt to the downside. Now, let's also then just pay attention to what has happened on previous occasions in other cycles. So this bull market started in 2008. The wider market bottomed in 2009. Then we've had significant multiple occasions on which the market has come back into the region of that 1,000-day moving average. But the last time that happened was in early 2016. It's worth reminding ourselves as well that there's been a significant acceleration in the pace with which the average stock has been rising. So it's perhaps just worth the time to take a moment to talk about what this index actually is. They look at the total number of shares on the New York Stock Exchange, take all the numbers, all the stocks that rise on a day, take those, the number of those that fall away from that number, they come up with a total value. And that is then added to the index at the end of the day. So when this index is trending higher, it means that the majority of shares are rising. When it's trending lower, it means that the average share is falling. But when we then start to see these lengthier periods where we get the advanced decline line, not just declining for a period of time, but trending downwards, well, then that generally corresponds with really significant deteriorations in the stock market. So the last time that happened was in 2007 and 2008. Now let's just also think about what happened prior to that event. Because we'd obviously had a significant bull market ahead of the peak in 2007, and then the subsequent decline. And if we just think then about everything that's happened in that run-up to the peak in 2007, well, there was a mania in the commodity markets, and that was most particularly evident. And I'm just looking here that I'm surprised that we don't have more history than back to 2004 for this index. But we can see that it had trended higher in a very profound manner for years. In the fertilizer sector, prices were going crazy by the time we got to the peak in 2008 because people thought we were going to run out of food. There was the consensus that China was going to continue to build infrastructure at a pace that was previously unknown in human history, and that was going to represent a phenomenal continued advance in demand for resources, and they would have to pay whatever price was necessary. Then, of course, the average share peaked in 2007. The wider market crashed in 2008. So, I think these are rather important things to pay attention to, that these consensus views that the market can only go up, that property prices can only go up, that trends that have been in evidence for years already are going to persist indefinitely, that those are all hallmarks of really manic activity. And when the average share is trending downwards, then it's certainly a note for caution. Now, something that Ian Little sent through in here today is probably worth paying attention to. There's a huge amount of pessimism in the market right now. So, in talking about where the risks are, I think it's very important to be aware of the fact that markets are discounting mechanisms. So problems tend to be priced in rather quickly. Then they have to be seen to be getting worse in order to continue to have a negative effect on markets. But we're at a rather difficult period right now. Investors have a lot of cash. We've had a phenomenally large quantity of money printed over the course of the last few years in response to the pandemic. Governments and central banks clearly panicked and went out of their way to massively increase the supply of money. So it's perhaps not that relevant to talk about how much cash do investors have on the sidelines, because the sheer volume of cash that they have available is outsized relative to what would be normal. But certainly something that we can pay attention to is that the number of people that are expecting a stronger economy is back in the region of where it was back in 2008. So that's also a lead indicator for those for overweights in equities. So the best time to be overweight equities is when a recession or recessionary fears trough and then start to rise again. But we're not quite there yet. Then this, I think, is another chart that's particularly interesting. So it's the recession of people, the net percentage of people saying a recession is likely. Well, what I find interesting is that it takes a while. So we can go back and think about 2007. We know that the advanced decline line for the NYSE peaked in 2007, and nobody was talking about a recession. By the time we got through to 2008, even though the market was already declining, then it was still only about 20% of people were talking about a recession. Well, then by the time we were actually in a recession and we'd already had a crash, people were talking about the recession. And of course, we had a lot of people talking the same way in 2020, and now we're having it again. But let's just think about the amount of time between these two peaks, where one was in 2009, the other one in 2020, and now we have another big move on the upside in 2022. So we have 12 years between one, and then only two between the last. Nobody was thinking about a recession a year ago. Now lots of people think there's going to be a recession, and I do wonder whether this isn't just simply a reflection of the snapback that we're getting because of the quantity of money that was printed. Aren't we instead more in a short-term cycle or right now because of the first the fear, then the response, then the unintended consequences of all that money printing. And of course, inflation is far and away the most important one of those. Then subsequently, we're starting to see now panic at the rise in inflation and at the extraordinary pressure that policymakers are being put under to do something about it. Then we're now heading towards a recession because they're trying to kill off demand. You have Larry Summers talking today about the need to raise taxes by a lot and do it quickly, not for the laudable reason of trying to curtail the deficit, but rather as a means of killing demand. Well, there is just, I don't know of a politician out there who could possibly follow through on that kind of suggestion, and I'm sure Summers is aware of that when he makes those kinds of recommendations. And then there's this additional chart. So it shows us the cash levels. So I was talking about cash levels previously. And then we're at cash levels now that haven't been seen since April of 2020, or October of 2016, or June of 2012, or December of 2008. So we've seen multiple occasions where cash levels have been around this peak before, but they have almost universally coincided with a return to significant money printing by central banks. And that's the one thing that central banks are not talking about right now. So I have sympathy with the view that stocks pulling back by double digits and the Nasdaq down in excess of 30% at one point, and probably now about 26%, something to that effect. Let's find out. So we have the net change, and I'm actually quite surprised why this isn't showing the same data. And sorry, I put up the futures version. The Nasdaq is down 24% this year. The Dow Jones is down 12, and this S&P 500 is down at just less than 17%. And usually, around these, the size of a 20% pullback would create a buying opportunity. Then, if we think about the Nasdaq 100, it has exceptionally large companies, and it's right in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. We've had a good size rebound over the course of the last 3 weeks, but it wasn't quite able to hold all of the move in here today. Now, if we simply take the, it's very easy to just get wedded to moving averages. So for a moment, let's just take them off and think about the consistency of the trend. So we've had this large decline in 2020 and a very swift V-shaped recovery. Then subsequently, we had reactions that were reasonably similar sized. And then we had another one, but it failed to hold a breakout and then pulled back into the other underlying range, then steadied, but then broke downwards. So the market was now at a new low. By the time we got to April of this year, it had broken its sequence of higher reaction lows. Now we had a breakdown and an extension of the breakdown, but then there was an upside weekly key reversal. So that would certainly have been a tradable signal, and it was enough to support the price for 3 weeks. And then prices started to come back down again, and they fell for consecutive weeks. So not only then failing to hold that breakout, but then breaking downwards again and coming down to the low in May. So then we had a range. And now we're having another range. And there was a range above the last. So this is the second range, and each of these ranges is below the last. And that suggests that the minimum requirement to question the consistency of this downtrend will be a sustained move back above 13,000. And that's the bare minimum to question the consistency of the decline. So a rational investor might look then at the longer term chart, most particularly that run up from the low in 2008, and just simply think about the consistency that we've had a rhythmic advance where we had ranges one above the last. Then we had a significant dip in 2018, but the succession of higher reaction lows was more or less sustained, and the breakdown was only held for a week or two. Then we got another pop on the upside. We had a big trend in consistency in early 2020, and then the index accelerated. There is absolutely no other way to categorize what happened after the peak, or excuse me, after the low in 2020 up to the peak in 2021. The price of or the index more than doubled. Now, we can even then just look at this on a log scale chart, because some investors won't be willing to really think about the fact that acceleration was present on an arithmetic scale, because most investors are not leveraged. We can even see the acceleration on a log scale chart. It became more overextended relative to the 1,000-day moving average than at any point since the low in 2008 and 9. So now it's in the region of the 1,000-day moving average again, and it has unwound about half of the big acceleration. So just from a longer term perspective and the consistency of the secular bull market, it absolutely needs to hold the low put in 3 weeks ago. But we're at the first point of resistance for the emerging downtrend. So there is a war going on between supply and demand. Some investors are going to be very eager to think that now is an ideal buying opportunity because we have these very negative sentiment indicators. There's a lot of cash on the sidelines. There's a lot of pessimism about the future of economic growth. And they know that historically, the only response to a recession that the Federal Reserve has is to flood the market with liquidity. So the logical conclusion then would be to start buying now and to be willing to continue to buy. The bears, on the other hand, will be of the view that this entire accelerated period of growth and asset price appreciation since the lows in 2020 was simply a chimera, that it was completely funded by panicky activity by central banks, and there was just too much liquidity, that we are now paying the price for that in terms of inflation, and that all of the liquidity that was injected will have to be withdrawn, and inflation isn't going to be brought back under control until that's been achieved. So that's the bearish view. And if that is the correct view, then asset prices will also have to come back down to where they were in early 2020. And that suggests that there's still a ways to fall. Now, I've been of the view that in order for this market to eventually peak, the relative performance of the largest companies will have to lead on the downside. And they haven't been doing that yet. So the relative index did spectacularly well all the way through until the end of last year. And a range has been forming since then. And now the ratio is pulling back from the 200-day moving average, and there's a sequence of lower rally highs since the end of last year. But this is an emerging top formation, and it hasn't yet been completed. So we still have large cap companies that are capable of surprising on the upside. So Tesla popped on the upside in here this week, but wasn't quite able to hold on to all of its advance in here today. But then we should also just pay attention to this longer term chart. It is no longer consistent. We have had a much larger pullback, and more importantly, it is back well inside the underlying range. So this is a major trend in consistency, and the best case scenario is for volatile ranging. Google had been able to close well off its lows yesterday, but then declined in here today. So gave up all of that advance and more. So it's still looking like a clear acceleration, loss of uptrend consistency, and now an emerging downtrend. And if we put that those moving averages back on, well, they do tend to give us some perspective on where people were willing to buy in the past and where people represent deep value during big medium-term corrections. So we're not that far away from the latter, but the former is certainly trending lower now. So there's certainly a lot of questions that still need to be answered. Meta Platforms was down in a dynamic manner in here today. So still a quite consistent trend on the downside. And the number of large cap companies that have been able to hold it together has been shrinking really quite abruptly. So Nvidia is also in the region of that 1,000-day moving average, and it had the bounce, and now it's starting to roll over again. We're also seeing quite a bit of divergence in the performance of different companies within the same sector. So Nucor, for example, had popped on the upside yesterday on strong earnings, then came straight back down to post a downside key reversal in here today on the back of lower manufacturing activity. And that's also a lead indicator for a recession. You can't have a recession without factories doing worse. And we've had some really quite profound activity within the fixed income markets. So the difference between the 10-year and the 2-year is down to 22 basis points. So this is a deep inverted condition. We haven't seen anything like it since 2006 and 7. And then it's also worth just paying attention to how quickly the spread between the 10-year and the 3-month is contracting. Because at the beginning of July, it was at around 150 basis points, and as of the end of today, it's at 37. So by the end of next week, we could have an inverted condition for the difference between the 10-year and the 3-month. So what it is very clearly stating is if the Federal Reserve persists in raising interest rates, a recession is absolutely inevitable. And investors are already willing to look through that. So there's a very clear belief that we're going to have a shallow recession. Now, I don't know if the second quarter of this year has been a contraction event for the US economy. But it's possible we might have a recession confirmed by next week. But it doesn't really matter. It's more about the willingness of central banks to provide assistance and increase liquidity. Now, of course, we have a large quantity of debt that's outstanding. And it was certainly something that I've been rather interested in over the last year, was at this argument about how high can yields really go when you don't have young demographics. So there's a very clear long-term correlation between the countries that have high median age populations. They generally tend to have low yields. And of course, the clear examples of that are Japan and Germany and Switzerland. And then you have a country like South Korea, which also has an aging population, and it's one of the fastest aging countries in the world, but it tends to have higher yields than Japan or Germany. But of course, there is the existential dread risk that's associated with being right next door to North Korea. So that's a reason why there should be a risk premium on South Korean bonds, even though it's an aging society. Now, the USA has generally got a higher median age than European countries, but not substantially higher. And therefore, isn't it likely then that Japanization of the treasury curve is more likely than not during this cycle? So, the ECB raised rates in here this week. And the question, of course, that everyone is asking is, are they going to be able to continue to do it? And will they be able to sustain that 50 basis point hike? Europe has tried to raise rates on a few occasions now since the beginning of the sovereign wealth crisis, and they've failed. Japan has tried to raise rates and never succeeded, and now they've pretty much given up. So the big question then is, since we're a decade on, and now the USA has got the issue with the baby boomers retiring and a larger proportion of people in the retirement age group, can yields rise? Well, at least at the moment, the bond market is kind of voting no. So 10-year yields got up to about 3.5% and are failing. The price or the yield is now down to 2.75%. There is a very real possibility that we're looking at not just a failed upside break to new highs, but a completing top formation. So we're at the first area of potential resistance now. The next would be the region of the 200-day moving average. And then subsequently, if it were to fall through that 200-day moving average, well, then we have a very clear failed upside break, and that would suggest that we go back down and test the lower side of the range, which is around 50 basis points. Or if one wanted to be really conservative and just look at the old lows, so then the lower side of the range would be somewhere around 1.35%. But again, this gives us another example of just how much of an impact we've had, because first yields collapsed in 2020, then they snapped back and pushed through to a new high, and now they're starting to come back down again. I think that if we then think about the yield curve spread, that what we have is this very rhythmic environment from 1990 through to 2014. And we've had long periods where the yield curve had took its time contracting. And every time it troughed, then it got up towards the 250 to 300 basis point level. So on this occasion, it didn't manage to do that. So we've had a really phenomenally impressive bull market since the trough in 2020. And now we're going to have a recession. And what I anticipate is that just like we've had a short, sharp expansion and bull market, that what we're now likely to have is a short but sharp recession. And that it's going to then contribute to remedial action, but not on a scale that we've come to expect. And that we're perhaps the most or the easiest way to describe what I'm thinking about is a pinball machine. That first you see the pinball jumping higher, then it bounces hard off of something, but it doesn't come back as quickly. Then it goes back slower, and then goes back less quickly, and goes back slower again. And I think that this is what we're going to have. We're going to have a pinball effect in the global economy, that we've had the shock, we've had the rebound. Now we're going to have the hangover. And the hangover is going to be painful, but it's not going to last indefinitely long. And then the subsequent rebound is going to do more to get us back to normal than the original rebound. And that would suggest that what we're in fact looking at for the next few years is going to be disappointing longevity in bull markets. That we're not going to have these kinds of decade-long moves where we have beautiful consistency, but rather we're going to move into choppy markets. And that would suggest that there are going to be some multi-year periods where we get really strong advances. And it's going to look like we're moving into a new bull market. But then central banks have now learned the inflationary lessons. They're not going to be as tolerant of speculative activity in future, and therefore they'll start to rein in liquidity much faster in future, because central banks and generals are always fighting the last war. So what that would suggest, at least to me, is that we're going to get some really significant buying opportunities during the current bear market. We've already seen that a lot of the more speculative portions of the market have pulled back in very violent manners. Now, the one thing about a type 3 bottom is that we get the accelerated decline. Then we get a big counter trend rally. And then subsequently, it moves. People use that rally to get rid of some of their outstanding inventory, and then prices start to come back down. So the ARK Innovation ETF has completely unwound all of its advance and is steadying in the region of the 2020 lows. But it needed liquidity to do well in 2020, and it's going to need liquidity to do well again. Then we can think about Bitcoin, because the price has been hovering around the 20,000 level, and it's closing out the week around 23,000. But it has popped on the upside. It has broken out of this short-term range. So there is at least some evidence of some interest returning to some of these speculative assets. But the big tax on consumption that we haven't talked about yet is oil. So I was of the view for a long time that oil is in a secular bear market, and that there wasn't really any evidence to suggest that the bear market was over, because the USA is now a significant exporter, whereas it had previously been the largest importer. So something has changed because prices have soared back up above $100 a barrel. Now they're closing out the week closer to $100. So surging oil prices are also they're a tax on consumption, but more to the point, they're a lead indicator of future recessions. And the longer these high prices are sustained, the greater the likelihood is that we will have recessions. Now, the ECB raised rates this week because they're terrified of inflation. But it's not like that's going to forestall some of the recession fears that are coming. It's probably going to exaggerate them. And Russia might have restarted the Nord Stream pipeline in here this week, but capacity is only running at about 30%, and there's absolutely no guarantee that they won't shut it off tomorrow or any other day. And it is very much in Russia's interest to ensure that Europe is cold this winter, because they need leverage to bring Europe to the table, and they want to ensure that Ukraine stays within their sphere of influence. But even then, the fact that both Finland and Sweden have joined NATO, that's going to be problematic from a Russian perspective. So we're in an environment where global growth is slowing down and manufacturing activity is rolling over. So that is likely to cut into demand. And of course, the problem right now is that it's very difficult to get money to invest in new supply. So when we think about the large companies, they've historically spent billions and tens of billions on investing in new supply. And right now, they're not in a position to go out and ask for money to go off and invest in new supply because they won't be given it. So this is obviously problematic because oil wells are wasting assets and you need to invest to sustain production and you need to invest to go out and find new production. Well, in this occasion, it's not like they don't know where the new production can be found. They know where the oil is. They spent a decade during the last commodity bull market finding out where it is. But we're in a situation, and I think it's again rather interesting, that this potential for slower cycles, or sorry, not slower but shorter cycles, is also going to create volatility in other markets. But most particularly in funding markets. And one of the problems for the energy sector is the volatility that we have in energy prices is detracting from their ability to make long-term investments because they just don't know what the regulatory environment is going to be. And then they also worry about cybersecurity. And they don't feel like they're being adequately protected or that they can go out and deploy the kinds of technology they'd like to in order to boost supply because they're worried about cyber attacks. So these are really significant factors. It's not like they didn't have enough to worry about by losing all of their endowment investors. But now they have to worry about being robbed or their operations being attacked because of geopolitical factors. I've been reading Daniel Yergin's book, where he does a really good job of talking about how long the conflict in Ukraine has been going on for, and how surprised Russia has been that Ukraine wanted to plot an independent path closer to the European Union and NATO rather than the oppression of Russia. But the reality is that Russia is feeling pretty paranoid. They believe that everyone is out to get them, and right now they're probably not wrong. But the reality too is that the permafrost is melting. So that's contributing to much higher costs for sustaining production. And then their main commodity producing regions are underpopulated. So they view that as an internal weakness, and they believe that the West is trying to exploit it. And they may have a point. But that doesn't mean that it's going to create a friendlier environment in the energy markets. And then, of course, we have at the natural gas price, and European natural gas prices are still right in the region of their peaks. So when, I wonder, are we going to have a real conversation about the wishful thinking and romanticism of the environmental movement compared to the real world of geopolitics and the cold winters and the unreliability of the renewable energy sector? So natural gas prices are still high. They're not coming back down in the Netherlands. There's a great deal of reluctance to sponsor the nuclear sector, but I think that that's probably inevitable. But it's going to be, well, just because we can see what the ultimate answer is, it doesn't mean that there isn't many a slip between the cup and the lip, that we're going to have a huge amount of discussion. And it's just going to take time for these kinds of solutions to come through. That the costs associated with mining and with electric vehicles, the pressure that puts on the electrical grid, and then the need to have backup natural gas power to make up for the times when the sun's not shining or the wind's not blowing, well, that just is an additional cost which is going to contribute to lower economic growth at a time when debt issues are starting to become problematic in Europe. Obviously, this is all still in the pipeline. Meanwhile, the Italian government fell this week. Mario Draghi resigned, and Italian bond yields compressed rather than rose, because the reality in Europe is that the Italian bond market is so large and is so integral to the European project that there's just no way that the ECB can allow a higher yield. So that's also contributing to the spread not getting out of control either. The ECB is raising rates. I don't think anybody really thinks they're going to be able to sustain it. And inevitably, they're going to have to help to support the European economy because Europe is looking at a significant recession. And it's not just because of Russian energy, but it's also about China. China's population are basically saying they don't want to pay their mortgages. Well, they don't want to pay their mortgages. And what I find interesting is that this data had to be imputed because as soon as it started cropping up, the Communist Party censored it. So we can see here that there's no data in the Northeast and there's no data in Yunnan or Xinjiang or Tibet. But right across a broad swathe of the country, there are people that are no longer willing to pay their mortgages. And they're not doing that because some of the property developers who took their money on the promise that they would build aren't building. So people don't want to pay their mortgages. And on the back of that, suppliers aren't paying their invoices because they want to get paid by companies like China Evergrande. So this is weighing on sentiment. And property prices are falling. So that's an additional reason why people are refusing to pay their mortgages. Why on earth would you pay a mortgage on a house that hasn't been built yet when the value of that property is going down? And they do risk losing their deposit, but they will argue that they've already lost their deposit because the property doesn't exist and its nominal value has probably fallen through the value of the deposit in the first place. And of course, this is seriously problematic for the government. So they are clearly saying that the property developers need to step up infrastructure development, and there's money being made available to do that in the order of hundreds of billions. But we have not yet seen any evidence of demand returning in the commodities markets. So copper has steadied over the course of the last 10 sessions, but has so far failed to push back above that $3.50 level. We've also seen a significant amount of volatility in the iron ore market. So prices have come down in a really quite dynamic manner. So I think this was there this has been a significant deterioration. And it's weighing on the industrial metal miners. If China isn't just talking about the need to create more infrastructure and is in fact acting, then demand for the raw materials they're going to require to achieve their goals will start to increase. And we just don't have evidence of that yet. So, China is at a significant risk of slower growth. And many people are willing to give the benefit of the doubt to the low growth in Q2 and say that it is completely COVID related. But this new variant is much more transmissible and China has got a large population of unvaccinated people that don't have natural immunity. So they're going to be dealing with the coronavirus on a whack-a-mole ad hoc basis for the foreseeable future. And the quarantine solution isn't going to last indefinitely. But the longer they hold on to it, well, then the greater the long-term break it's going to have on the on the Chinese economy. And that's terrible news for Europe because they're very much dependent on China buying their exports. Now you have senior European politicians in Taiwan right now, and Nancy Pelosi from the US is due to visit there as well. They're playing in China's backyard, and China's not going to take that lightly. The most important thing to remember about a communist regime is that politics matters more than anything else. So they're not going to be willing to take are there well, I guess the other way to think about it is they're going to take umbrage at any attempt to give any kind of leeway to negotiate to Taiwan. They want Taiwan back in the fold. and they have been actively trying to court politicians within Taiwan for years. And they would like to have a recession and then pack the results with their own people. But obviously, these are long-term solutions for China. And meanwhile, the TAIEX has got an eerily similar pattern to the NASDAQ 100, but it's also steadying from the region of the 1,000-day moving average. So I think we're starting to see some opportunities evolve on an ad hoc basis because we have oversold conditions and valuations have improved. But until we see an answer to the absence of liquidity, then this is going to be a volatile environment where we'll have big short covering rallies and counter trend short term moves, but still evidence of clear downtrends overall. And importantly, the total assets of central banks have contracted from about 33.5 trillion to about 30. So this has been a really significant contraction in central bank balance sheets, but the size of the Fed's balance sheet or anyone else's hasn't declined. It's really been about the dollar. So the dollar is emblematic of risk being taken out of the global economy and money flowing back into the US, and then also the interest rate differential in support of the US. So the dollar index has pulled back and unwound the short-term overbought condition. And that's also lent some additional liquidity to the wider market. But we're not there yet. It hasn't quite broken down. And until it pulls back through 105, then we have to continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. If we think about the Asia dollar index, well, then it's back in the region of the lows from 2020. This is Asian currencies falling versus the dollar. But it's going to have to do more than just steady to signal that this is more or anything other than short-term support. So gold prices were up in a dynamic manner yesterday, and we had an upside, key reversal, and follow-through in here today. But it wasn't quite able to hold all of the advance, and this so far is steadying in the region of the lower side of the 2-year range and pausing in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. I haven't bought back in yet because I'd like to see some additional follow-through. I think that it's more likely than not we're going to see a retest of these lows. We're just not in a confidence-inducing period right now, so I'm a little gun-shy about increasing short-term trading positions just over the next few days, particularly as we head into the Federal Reserve meeting on Wednesday. But I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.